Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has noted with concern that sanctions by the United States against the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC. Following Mr. Guterres' statement on Wednesday, the ICC condemned the US move. The court said that the measures were another attempt to interfere with the court's independence and work to address grave crimes of concern to the international community, as mandated under the ICC Rome Statute. The ICC has faced criticism from the United States since it was founded in 2004. Along with Russia and China, the US is one of a dozen countries that has not recognized its jurisdiction. The development follows the Hague-based court's inquiry into whether US forces committed alleged war crimes in Afghanistan. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo accused the ICC of illegitimate attempts to subject Americans to its jurisdiction before announcing the sanctions against Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda and another senior official, Fakiso Mochochoko. The initiative is in line with a U.S. executive order issued in June by President Donald Trump involving blocking property of certain persons associated with the ICC. The UN Health Agency has issued global guidance for the use of readily available and cheap steroid medication to treat people dangerously ill with COVID-19. Based on data from several trials involving thousands of participants, a World Health Organization, WHO-convened panel of international experts said with moderate certainty that corticosteroids probably reduce mortality in critically and severely ill patients by up to 87 fewer deaths per 1,000 patients. In addition, the panel said that the synthetic steroids, such as dexamethasone, methylprednisolone, and hydrocortisone likely reduce the need to ventilate patients. They also said with low certainty that giving people such steroids who are not severely infected with the new coronavirus may increase the risk of death, hence the recommendation to medics not to use steroid therapy in cases of non-severe COVID-19 infection. Corticosteroids are listed in the WHO model list of essential medicines. They are readily available globally at a low cost. On the use of the antiviral drug remdesivir, the UN agency said that its beneficial effect remains uncertain, despite recent evidence suggesting that it may help to speed up recovery from severe cases of infection. Globally, more than 25.6 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 have been reported to WHO, including more than 852,000 deaths. Protection concerns are growing for the millions of refugee children who cannot afford to return to school because of the economic impact of the COVID-19 crisis. Girls are particularly at risk, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, warned, as they are likely to be exposed to greater exploitation than boys if they're not in class. Sajjad Malik, UNHCR's Director of Resilience and Solutions, said that all around the world, parents have been forced to put their children to work instead of going to school because they can't pay for lessons. Attacks on schools are also increasing, the UN agency warned in a new report on global education. More positively, UNHCR found that an important threshold had been passed in higher education, with 3% of refugees going to university, up from just 1%. This meant that thousands more vulnerable youngsters were now benefiting from tertiary education, the UN agency said. It highlighted the support from the German government and the private sector for Delphi scholarships, which ensure that refugees can attend universities all over the world. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and I might also say, je suis Charlie. I am Charlie. We'll be talking about the trial of the assassins of Charlie Hebdo magazine workers. We'll be talking about blasphemy in Nigeria, the rise of Christian white nationalism, state church separation in Puerto Rico, and so much more today.
And I'm Dan Barker. This is the September 3rd, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Annie Laurie and I are hosting again from our Safer at Home studio in Madison, Wisconsin, while Buzz Kemper, the famous Buzz Kemper, is engineering the show from Audio for the Arts, his recording studio near the Wisconsin State Capitol.
Free Thought Radio is, of course, the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're a radio show and podcast. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation does so much more. We are a national association of freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics, working as an umbrella organization to protect the cherished principle of separation between religion and government in the United States, which is greatly under siege, and we would love to have your support as a member if you are not already one, or send you more information. Just go to our webpage at ffrf.org and click the donate button or click the ask for information button, and we'll be in touch with you.
In the second half of our show today, we're going to talk about white supremacy and religion with the scholar and author Robert P. Jones. He's the CEO and founder of Public Religion Research Institute. His new book is called White Too Long: The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity.
And in a few minutes, we're going to talk with our legal fellow, attorney Brendan Johnson. He is our Robert G. Ingersoll legal fellow, about some recent victories that he has gotten for the separation between state and church, including removing a prayer locker from a Texas public school.
The music between segments today is by the jazz saxophonist Virginia Mayhew, who's the daughter of a longtime member of FFRF, Anne Helms. And Anne Helms is the daughter of the famed photographer Ansel Adams. We will hear the songs In Walked Bud, Sandan Shuffle in 7/8 time, Tenderly in 5/8 time, and Let's Fall in Love in 7/8 time.
And we are proud to announce that starting next week, you'll be able to watch our iconic advertisement with Ron Reagan, who recorded a wonderful commercial for us that has been largely censored by many of the networks, but is allowed to run on NBC, Comedy Central, and sometimes CNN. And so you can look next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday on the Rachel Maddow Show for the ad to appear just once each night, and then there'll be a few more sightings of this ad on the Maddow Show in September. And I'm still waiting for the dates, but the ad will be appearing four times on The Daily Show on Comedy Central in upcoming weeks in September, so keep your eyes peeled. And I think we're going to play that ad for you just to remind you how fun it is.
Hi, I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective association of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate, just like our founding fathers intended. Please support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
And that's become something of a catchphrase for us, hasn't it?
Yes, you can go to ffrf.org/unabashed and make your own virtual digital billboard, unabashed, whatever you want to fill in with your name. We have caps, T-shirts, a button, a bumper sticker, you name it, now with this very iconic phrase that Ron so irreverently came up with himself, and we want to thank him once again for lending his name and his irreverency to the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
On last week's show, we briefly mentioned our recent victory in our first lawsuit in Puerto Rico, a combined action with the Secular Humanists of Puerto Rico. A public school was forcing prayer on the students. Last week on Ask an Atheist, which is our weekly live TV show on Facebook, we spoke with Eva Quiñones and Gerardo Rivera of the Secular Humanists of Puerto Rico, celebrating that victory. Here is Eva Quiñones explaining the case.
The mother of these two girls in a public school in Puerto Rico recorded some religious ceremonies at the school. When she asked her daughters what was going on, turns out that the girls were being harassed because they didn't want to participate. And they told a social worker in the school that they really didn't believe in that. And they didn't think they could be made to show up or that the activities themselves should happen. And they told the mother, and when the mother complained, the school actually like shut down on them, shut down on the mother and the girls, and started moving them around from one class to the other. And they started to tell other parents in the school that these are the Satanists, these are the atheist girls and the mother. And some of the grades were affected because of this. And the mother complained in the school, and she was basically shut down too. So she came to us. We had talked to Van at some point about maybe you guys at Freedom from Religion Foundation to help us in one of these lawsuits. And Van said yes. And we sued the Department of Education. And that has been a dream of mine ever since I've been aware of what an atheist means and the Constitution and separation of church and state. So dream come true for many people here, and especially for me.
And Eva also was very gracious in thanking our staff attorney, Sam Grover, who has been tied up in deposition, so we haven't been able to have him on to talk about this show. And of course, we want to thank our very brave mother plaintiff and her two children who were being stigmatized greatly. It's a great victory that we hope to build on in Puerto Rico, and we're thrilled that we have taken and won our first federal lawsuit in Puerto Rico to protect the rights of conscience of public school children not to be indoctrinated and preyed upon by religion during the public school day. So, and now to another part of the world, a very alarming situation in Nigeria, where an atheist and a humanist leader whose name is Mubarak Bala has been arrested for criticizing the practices of Muslims during the coronavirus pandemic. Actually, he was not arrested. He was detained in April and disappeared. Nobody knows what has happened to him. There was a big article last week in the New York Times. He is the president of the Humanist Association of Nigeria.
And under Nigerian law, Mubarak Bala could face the death penalty for blasphemy. Yesterday on Ask an Atheist, we spoke with the founder and former president of the Humanist Association of Nigeria, Leo Igwe, by Skype from his home in Ibadan. Leo, who's a friend of Bala, is working fervently for his release. During yesterday's show, he explained the situation.
Well, Mubarak Bala actually came out in a very, what people may call, controversial way. In 2014, he came out as an ex-Muslim. And that decision did not go down well with the family. So he continued with his work. It is a work of education. It's a work of enlightenment. That is what Mubarak is trying to do, because he understands the damage. And let me tell you what he told me briefly before they arrested him. As soon as there was an outbreak of coronavirus, some Muslims were saying there was nothing like that. And they actually instituted a club, what they call the coronavirus football club. They organized a match, and people were playing football, trying to win a cup against all the guidelines for the management of the pandemic, against social distancing, shaking of hands, wearing of face masks. So he was always very angry, not very happy with the fact that in the name of Islam, many people want to get away with so much in terms of going against common sense, going against science, even going against human rights. So what he was doing was trying to educate and enlighten the people. He was making posts on Facebook, and eventually some Muslims who were not happy with him petitioned the police, who came and arrested him on April 28th, and they disappeared him since then. And he doesn't have access to a lawyer. He doesn't have access to his family. We don't know exactly where he's being held. We actually even don't know whether he's alive or dead.
So this is a very fraught situation, and this is the kind of thing we need to have an absolute worldwide clamor over. The persecution and prosecution of atheists and humanists simply for not believing in religion. We need the eradication of blasphemy laws that exist in 70 states, one-third of them in African countries, the Freedom From Religion Foundation did write a letter to the State Department saying, what are you going to do to help this guy, you, Mr. Pompeo, who claim to be so big on religious liberty? And so far, we haven't had a reply.
And the some of the experts from the United Nations also have written two letters to the government of Nigeria, and so far with no reply at all. If you want to know more about this particular situation in Nigeria and also in Puerto Rico, you can watch both of those shows and many others on FFRF's Ask an Atheist channel on YouTube.
And what I would suggest is Google FFRF's Ask an Atheist playlist on YouTube, and then you'll see hundreds of shows, all very interesting, that have been uploaded weekly. And speaking of shows, the Freedom From Religion Foundation not only has this radio show and Facebook live show, but we have a TV show. It's called Free Thought Matters. It broadcasts around the country on Sunday mornings. It's in 12 markets, major markets, if you include Madison. We'd like to be in our hometown. On Sunday mornings in most places, you can find out if it's in your area, New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, or not San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis, a bunch of other places. By going to fffrf.org/news, there's a drop-down with Free Thought Matters, and you can find out when and how to watch the show. But we also upload it on YouTube. And we're very pleased that the debut season, the fall season, begins this Sunday, September 6th. And it is in honor of the centennial of Women's Equality Day, the right to vote, the 19th Amendment. We talk with the journalist, author, TV personality, Eleanor Clift, who went from a secretary at Newsweek in the early 60s to becoming Newsweek's White House correspondent. She has appeared in movies as herself, movies you've seen, but perhaps she's best known as a panelist on the syndicated talk show The McLaughlin Group.
I asked Eleanor Clift what it was like being one of the first women on a political talk show, especially such a pugilistic show, which she has compared to a televised food fight.
That was back in the day when male talk show hosts didn't really concern themselves much with diversity. And so when the world started changing, and I would say when the abortion debate became political, you couldn't have five men sitting around. And so women were brought into the debate because the men were discussing what they thought women's issues. And so when I say these things today, young women look at me like I'm from another planet, but that is what it was like. And so John McLaughlin, who was a former Jesuit priest, and the Jesuits are known as the Green Berets in the Army of God, he was very booming voice, very certain of all his opinions. He realized that he needed to bring in a woman's voice. And I was not the only woman he tried out, but he did keep coming back to me, and I eventually became a regular on the show. But I remember my first appearances, and I would say something, and they would kind of look at me somewhat politely and let me speak, and then they would simply go back to what they were doing. It wasn't until they felt they could, like, throw a punch at me and that I would respond that I became part of the show. At the time, I didn't realize how iconic the show was or would be, but it really was the sort of the granddaddy of the political talk shows that we see today.
And then, of course, we went on to talk about the founding sisters, about the 19th Amendment. Eleanor Clift wrote a wonderful, breezy book. The whole history kind of tied up very, very good. She talks about that history. She talks about women in journalism. And actually, you can watch that show now. It's uploaded on YouTube every Thursday prior to being broadcast on Sundays. Just look for the Free Thought Matters playlist at FFRF's YouTube site. And she was most gracious. Her late husband, Tom Brazidis, also a well-known journalist, was a fervent member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and we're very pleased we got to meet him before his untimely death.
So we have to take a break, and after the break, we're going to talk with FFRF's Robert G. Ingersoll legal fellow, Brendan Johnson, about some recent legal victories for state-church separation.
And on the second half of the show, we are going to interview scholar and author Robert P. Jones about his new book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. You won't want to miss this interview.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're delighted to be speaking with Brendan Johnson. He is an attorney, and he has just completed his first year as the Robert G. Ingersoll Legal Fellow for the Freedom From Religion Foundation. He's starting his second year. We've never had you on Free Thought Radio. That seems inconceivable. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here with you all.
So you have been racking up legal victories and some very important ones, including one out of, now I can't remember the Tennessee, the Morgan County School Board. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a complainant notified us that a nearby school board in Tennessee was opening every meeting with a prayer. And from our research, it appeared that the prayers were uniformly Christian, which is normal in this part of the country. And the nature of the school board meetings generally is such that children and their parents have a lot of reasons to be present and are often required to be present, which makes it very different from a legislative prayer situation, and which is why we and federal courts have found school board prayer to be particularly constitutionally problematic. So we sent a letter, and the school board president got back to us actually pretty quickly, more quickly than normally, and notified us that they would no longer have prayer at the meetings. It was very terse. I don't know that he was happy about it, but we're glad that he did the right thing.
Yeah, well, and thanks to your letter, and it also invoked the fact that the Freedom From Religion Foundation recently won a big victory against school board prayer before the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, so that didn't hurt. Now, you had another victory that is a very weird case. It was new to me, but apparently it's a new trend. It was about a prayer locker in the school. So tell us about that.
A prayer locker? Like a student locker?
Yeah. So this is something that we've been starting to see on the intake team, which is that schools and different government organizations across the country are starting to have these things called prayer lockers pop up, where they'll, in some places, it will be just a box. But in this school, in Prairieland Junior High in Pattonville, Texas, there was an actual student locker that was reserved in order for students to insert prayer requests to a specific Christian group called Youth for Christ. And we received a complaint and wrote on it, asking them to take, you know, the Christian iconography off the locker and quit using it in this way, because it's fairly inconceivable that any other religion would be offered such, you know, a benefit, and even if they did, that would also be unconstitutional. After receiving our letter, I received quite the angry response from the principal, accusing me of doing this for personal profit. I hate to break it to him, but we're not paid per letter. Fortunately, rather than respond, since we had written to the superintendent, we waited and hoped that cooler heads would prevail. And they did, and the superintendent agreed to take the locker down.
So we have a press release about this that went out Monday, August 27th, so someone can go and look at the picture. if you go to fffref.org/news for our news releases. And I'm looking at the picture, and it says in big letters, prayer locker, and there's a great big Latin cross. And then it says, drop prayer here. And then the purpose of this locker was to encourage students to submit prayer requests to an outside group. Do you remember what that outside group was?
Yeah, it was called Youth for Christ.
So it's really quite proselytizing. So, again, I had not heard this, and I'm sorry to hear that it is a trend, but it certainly is most inappropriate.
I wonder if any of the atheist students ever put any pieces of paper in there. That would be something to... I bet you that's something an atheist kid would do at a school like that.
So congratulations for that. And, Brendan, you have also got a senator mad at you. I can't remember if it's a U.S. senator or a state senator. What's that about?
Yeah, so Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, he's a U.S. senator, one of their two in Louisiana, has been posting Bible verses on his official government Facebook page every Sunday. And I received this complaint from a local, somebody in his district who has been receiving these and was curious about whether that was constitutional or what. And so I wrote the senator asking him to stop because it gives the apparent impression of government endorsement of Christianity and religion, both of which are not constitutional. Instead of responding politely, he gave the letter to some Christian news website and tried to duck responsibility by calling our request cancel culture, which is a strange red herring, but as if legal arguments about the questionable constitutionality of a government official's actions amount to cancel culture. I don't know what to tell him, but he did not seem pleased.
And didn't he send you an email, too?
I have not. I don't think I received an email from him, but I definitely got notification from people in Louisiana about his recalcitrance.
So this is a big, hot topic right now. We only have about half a minute left, but do you want to talk about the law? I'm sorry, we're out of time, but that really is inappropriate, and there is law and case law behind it. And we appreciate everything you've done for the Freedom From Religion Foundation to date, Brendan, in ending many of these violations. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk with the scholar and author Robert P. Jones. He's the founder and CEO of Public Religion Research Institute, about his new book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at fffref.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. Robert P. Jones is the CEO and the founder of Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI. He is a leading scholar. He's a commentator on religion and politics. And we have mentioned and featured some of his work on previous shows of ours. He's frequently featured in major national media such as CNN, NPR, New York Times, Washington Post. He holds a PhD in religion from Emory University and an MDiv from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary.
Robert P. Jones is the author of the 2016 book, The End of White Christian America. His new book, just released this summer, is White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And yes, Robbie, we have We footnote your work all the time, especially your surveys on the growing number of secular and non-religious Americans today.
So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks. I'm pleased to be here.
So I read your book, White Too Long. So tell us, where did that title come from, White Too Long?
Yeah, well, it comes from James Baldwin. It comes from a New York Times op-ed that he wrote at a moment of kind of despair, I think, and grief after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So he penned this op-ed just a few months after both King and Bobby Kennedy had been killed. And, you know, it comes to this place, I think he had hoped, I think, like King, held out this great hope that whites of goodwill, and in particular whites who had, you know, Christian values, would step up and really join the civil rights movement. And then I think just being deeply, deeply disappointed and again, I think close to despair after King was killed. It might be helpful to kind of give you the full context of the quote. It's a pretty tough quote, but I chose it because I think it could be very apt even for our current day. So here's the full context of the quote from this New York Times piece he wrote just a few months after King's death. "I will flatly say that the bulk of this country's white population impresses me, and has so impressed me for a very long time, as being beyond any conceivable hope of moral rehabilitation. They have been white, if I may so put it, too long. They have been married to the lie of white supremacy too long. The effect on their personalities, their lives, their grasp of reality has been as devastating as the lava which so memorably immobilized the citizens of Pompeii. They are unable to conceive that their version of reality, which they want me to accept, is an insult to my history and a parody of theirs and an intolerable violation of myself."
Yeah, talk about timely, and talk about timely, your book as well, coming out this summer.
So
it
like
is. Go ahead.
Well, it is very timely this summer too. And Baldwin's talking about starting over. You know, he thinks our country should start over with our attitudes. And
yeah,
like you, I was also raised in a white Christian family, and I had no idea of the history, which you point out in your book. The subtitle of your book is "The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity." You talk about the Southern Baptist split and all that. Give us a little breakdown of that legacy of white supremacy in America.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I mean, most white people I know who grew up in the Christian church would say exactly what you said. It was certainly my experience. And I should say, you know, I was that kid who was at church like 5 days a week. I mean, I was there all the time. I was, active in the youth group as an adolescent. I went to a Southern Baptist college. I have a master's degree from a Southern Baptist seminary. And through all of that, I can't remember hearing a single sermon about racial injustice or the civil rights movement. Certainly no educational materials about white Christian complicity in supporting slavery or opposing segregation. And you know, it's quite remarkable. I was in my 20s in seminary before I really understood the genesis story of my own denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention. And just briefly, you know, it the denomination was, I mean, I start the book with the sentence, you know, the denomination was literally founded as a place where slave owning and owning other human beings was seen as compatible with the gospel. That was the very reason for its being. It's called the Southern Baptist Convention because it was essentially a secessionist move among Baptists that predated the Civil War. This happened in 1845, but it was absolutely over the question of slavery and specifically whether clergy could legitimately own slaves. And when the Northern Baptists said they didn't think that was legitimate and against Christian teaching, the Baptist churches in the South kind of circled the wagons and said, well, we disagree, and created their own denomination. And it turned out it wasn't any fringe thing. By the time the middle of the 20th century comes around, this Southern secessionist, slave-owning and slave-justifying, enslavement-justifying denomination grew to be the largest Christian denomination in the country by the middle of the 20th century.
So you also point out that when you're talking about white Christian America, it's not just the Southern Baptists. You also show how the Methodists had the, you know, the same problem. And it even, you even include white American Catholics. So it's not just the Southern Baptists, although they seem to encapsulate that problem.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, it's maybe not that surprising, given the history that maybe even people know, right, about the Civil War, that white evangelicals who are a heavily Southern constituency might be entangled to the extent that we are in white supremacy. But I think what so the book follows like my own story out of that evangelical world, but it also uses social science data to look at the history and current public opinions among white mainline Protestants, which are often thought of as the more liberal end of the white Protestant world, and white Catholics, right, who themselves have a kind of complicated history of anti-Catholic sentiment and facing discrimination themselves. But what's remarkable in looking at the current public opinion data is that these attitudes, and I'll just give you one example that's right out of the headlines today. On this issue of the killing of African-American men by police, for example, white Christians of all kinds, not just white evangelicals, but white mainline Protestants and white Catholics, are about twice as likely as whites who are religiously unaffiliated to say that the killing of African-American men by police are just isolated incidents. That is, it's, you know, few bad apples, it's that whole rhetoric, but not connected. Those whites who are religiously unaffiliated, their attitudes are much closer to African-Americans on this question, who see the killing of African-American men by police as part of a pattern of how police treat African-Americans. And I can multiply the examples, which I do in the book, but essentially what we see when you boil it down is that white Christians have this massive moral blind spot when it comes to systemic injustice and specifically systemic racism in the country. And even when I test for various other things, it is in fact their Christian identity and the culture around white Christianity that is doing the work that really is kind of putting moral blinders on them and making these issues of systemic racism, rendering them essentially invisible.
Your book is very heavy on the data and on research, and you develop some of your own methodology in the book of teasing out. You know, when I was a believer, I would have denied that we had any problems, and yet you show through your research that, through their action, they say one thing but another. They say red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. And I especially enjoyed, maybe enjoy is the wrong word, but I especially appreciated a sentence that you said about if you were going to be a recruiter for a white supremacist group. Do you remember that sentence?
Yeah.
Where would you be most likely to find recruits?
Yeah, I mean, it was that was actually a painful sentence to write, but it was one that I really came to after just poring over this data and trying to break these models, right, which were pointing toward this strong relationship between racist attitudes on the one hand and white Christian identity on the other. Even when I introduced a bunch of controls to these statistical models that revealed this relationship, this stood up as an independent relationship. Even when I looked at church attendance, because I think often, as you said, I think people would kind of dismiss this or deny this relationship, or they would say things, well, maybe these are just Christians in name only, right, who aren't connected to a church, who aren't really getting educated or being formed in discipleship, to use Christian language. But when I looked at church attendance, it at best made no difference, right? So this relationship between holding racist attitudes and white Christian identity remained as strong overall, whether people attended frequently or not. And if you look specifically at white evangelicals, this relationship, again, between holding racist attitudes and white evangelical identity was actually stronger among those who attended more frequently. So in other words, attending church actually made white evangelicals hold more racist attitudes, not less here. And so I did conclude sort of at the end here, I'll just read this section. If you want to predict whether an average person is likely to identify as a white Christian, and you could only know one attribute about that person, you'd be better off knowing how racist he or she is than how often he or she attends church. Or to put it more bluntly, and this is the sentence you were talking about, if you were recruiting for a white supremacist cause on a Sunday morning, you'd likely have more success hanging out in the parking lot of an average white Christian church, evangelical, Protestant, mainline Protestant, or Catholic, than approaching whites sitting out services at the local coffee shop.
Huh. Yeah, that is quite a sentence there.
Yeah, we would have been those whites sitting in the local coffee shop talking about racial justice while in church they're talking about going to heaven or hell. So,
law and order, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You do say that being affiliated with a white Christian group is independently associated with approximately 10% increase in racist attitudes, and there's no significant relationship between white, religiously unaffiliated identity and holding racist attitudes.
Yeah, that's right. So, I was kind of analyzing this relationship in both directions. So it's both true that if you're looking about holding racist attitudes and whether that predicts white Christian identity, that positive relationship is there. It's not there. Holding racist attitudes does not predict being white and unaffiliated. And even if you flip it around, white Christian identity does predict, as you said, about a 10% increase in holding racist views, but there's no relationship between being white and unaffiliated there. And so what that really tells you is that it is the Christian identity part of that that is really doing the work. I mean, one other way to kind of boil it down in plain terms is that, if you take the average white person and you add Christianity, they move toward holding more racist attitudes than not.
We are talking with Robert P. Jones, the founder of Public Religion Research Institute, about his new book, kind of an expose, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. We have to take a break, but when we come back, Robbie, I hope there'll be time to talk about this riot in Colfax, Louisiana on Easter Sunday, 1873, and also why you say the sun has set on the era of white Christian dominance. I'm Annie Laurie Giller.
And I'm Dan Barker. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're continuing our conversation with Robert P. Jones, the CEO and founder of Public Religion Research Institute, whose new book, which just came out in July, about a month ago, is called White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity.
And Robbie, you write in your book about this terrible story that has been hushed up or forgotten about what happened in Colfax, Louisiana on Easter Sunday, 1873. Could you briefly recap that?
Sure. This is one of many stories that I have uncovered, and still there are hundreds more that have been really suppressed, forgotten. And so this is a story of right after the Civil War during Reconstruction, and where many black voters were enfranchised for the first time. And as a result, many African Americans were elected to office. As they were attempting to take office, a group of ex-Confederate soldiers decided to storm the county courthouse and prevent them from taking office. And a standoff occurred with African Americans kind of barricaded in to preserve their right to take office, and whites circling the the courthouse. And essentially they set fire to the courthouse and started firing on the courthouse, even with a small cannon. About 70 African Americans were killed in that fighting. Even when they surrendered, they marched 37 of them outside and executed them summarily right on the lawn. They continued to round people up during the day, jailed many, and executed 50 more that night.
Wow.
And you know, in the justification for this, this was this guy named Christopher Columbus Nash. I kid you not, and he was the head of this thing called the White League, which is a paramilitary operation that was designed to kind of, you know, hold up white supremacy. And he explicitly wrote that they did this for, quote, to protect, quote, the maintenance of our hereditary civilization and Christianity, menaced by a stupid Africanization. And that's the exact words that he used to kind of motivate this thing. And, you know, I think just one quick comment on this. I think when we hear today, as we were hearing from the president and others, and Franklin Graham and others, this throwing around our heritage and Western civilization, and, you know, and that if Joe Biden gets elected, for example, it'll be the end of Western civilization. That term and using it in this way has a long history, it comes right out of upholding a white supremacist worldview.
So this is like a dog whistle, and I should hasten to add that we, FFRF, in this show, is a political nonpartisan group.
And you point out in the book that the pastors in the churches were curiously silent through that whole riot. Well, it wasn't a riot. It was a massacre is what it was. There were no ministers on that Easter Sunday who even came to the help of anyone in there. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there seemed to be no big outlash, no evidence that anything massive happened among white Christian churches. And, you know, there are other stories in the book, too, that tell, for example, stories of in Atlanta of people, of white Christians going to church and literally leaving the church to get on a train to attend a lynching, and seeing really no conflict between, their whatever they heard inside their Christian churches on Sunday morning and going to be spectators and participants in lynching an African-American man that afternoon.
Yeah. So you challenge white Christians to acknowledge that public apologies are not enough, that they have to accept responsibility for the past. And in your conclusion, you say perhaps the most important step, first step toward health, is to recover from our white supremacy-induced amnesia. Could you? We only have about 3 minutes left or so, but could you kind of talk about how we're going to, and how Christians and white Christians and white people are going to recover and make amends?
Yeah. Well, I the first chapter of the book is titled Seeing, S-E-E-I-N-G, and I did that for a reason. I think, you know, personally speaking, it has meant kind of enlarging my own moral vision. As someone who identifies as white and Christian, and realizing the ways in which the Christianity in which I was raised has really blinded me to seeing systemic racism and injustice in the country. So I think just seeing that reality, and one simple thing I think that sort of whites and white Christians can do is just this, is that if we see our African-American brothers and sisters in pain, in anguish, angry, and telling us something is deeply wrong, if we could just have enough humility to stop and listen and take it seriously instead of dismissing it, even if we don't on the face of it understand it, but to have enough humility to say, you know what, we've missed enough in the past. We've been on the wrong side of this history enough in the past that maybe the most prudent thing for us to do is to sit with this long enough until we can actually empathize and hear what our, you know, and kind of feel, I think, the pain and anguish that we're seeing from our fellow African American citizens in the country. And I think maybe the last thing I'll say is that, you know, we began with James Baldwin. I'll end with James Baldwin, who I read a lot of working on this book. That, you know, he was calling for a kind of truth telling, and that we can't heal the country until we have a reckoning, and that involves telling the truth, and it also involves trying to repair the damage. But the first step is to tell the truth. And here's what he said: if we can find the courage to do that, and it's going to be a scary and maybe even a bitter experience for many white Christians to do this, but if we can find the courage to do this, and these are his words, we can end the racial nightmare. We can achieve our country, and we can change the history of the world. Now, he wrote that nearly six decades ago, but it could be written, in any op-ed in any newspaper in the country today.
Yes, it certainly could. And your book couldn't be more timely. We have about a minute left. A quick take on the Confederate flag controversy and who supports it.
Yeah, we see these same patterns really in the Confederate flag, and so again, we're looking at, something like 7 in 10 white Christians across the board, and here there's not that much difference again between white evangelicals, white mainline Protestants, and white Catholics on this question. And we have seen like some movement on the killing of African American men by police, at least among white Catholics. We've seen some movement there, but we've seen not much movement at all on the question of the Confederate flag. Just a little bit, but we're still seeing overwhelmingly more than 6 in 10 white Christians saying that the Confederate flag is more a symbol of Southern pride than a symbol of racism. Whereas whites who are unaffiliated, again, the same gap between whites who are Christian and whites who are unaffiliated, only about 4 in 10 whites who are unaffiliated say that the Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride, again, compared to more than 6 in 10 white Christians.
Well, thank you for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Robert P.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The author of the new book, I'm sorry, what's the name?
White Too Long.
White Too Long.
You've got two books here. White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, Buzz, for producing the show today. And thank you for listening, you listeners over in Philadelphia, listeners in Madison, Wisconsin, in Janesville, Wisconsin, in College Station, Texas, in Columbia, Missouri, to KOPN, in Bellows Falls, Vermont, and New Hampshire, WOOL, Black Sheep Radio. Listeners to WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York, and of course many thousands of podcast listeners. Find out more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
Yeah, and join the Freedom From Religion Foundation at our website, ffrf.org, or ask for more information, including a copy of our newspaper, Free Thought Today, that does carry so much more depth than we can always go into on these weekly shows. And your membership will support the nation's largest association of freethinkers working diligently to uphold the constitutional principle of state-church separation. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.